The ground towards the Pozieres Ridge saw heavy fighting in the summer of 1916, from a tragic, cancelled British attack through to the Australian assault on Pozieres village and the arrival of the Canadians. What can we find as we walk from La Boisselle to Pozieres? We're back with our now regular fortnightly episode of The Old Front Line, and I think having an episode, a main episode, every 2 weeks will continue for a little while yet. I've got a busy period of battlefield tours coming up over the next few months, covering locations both on the First and Second World War battlefields. And aside from that, if I'm honest, I still haven't quite caught up from having COVID nearly 2 months ago. And thanks to all of you who sent best wishes and kind comments on social media about that, so thank you for that. I'm feeling a lot better, back to normal, whatever normal is these days. But I am still behind with planning and thinking about the podcast and the episodes for the podcast. A lot of thinking does go into it because there's never a script. I have a running order now, so I don't kind of shoot off all over the place. But because I don't use a script, I like to have some time to think about what we're going to talk about in these episodes. And I haven't had so much of that, as certainly not as much as I would like. But I do plan to have some interviews coming up with some interesting people. So aside from the fortnightly main episodes, I'm hoping to get the odd bonus episode in. And of course, we will have our supporters' evenings still every month. And we've got another one of those coming up, I hope, very, very soon. I've just returned from a battlefield trip, not to the battlefields of the Great War, but to some Second World War battlefields in Italy, to Anzio and Monte Cassino. But of course, the paths of all of these battlefields crisscross so often. Anzio, as some of you follow me on social media will know, is a special place to me because my father fought there in conditions not dissimilar to the Great War, with trenches and observation posts, night patrols, barbed wire, no man's land. And his father had fought at Gallipoli in 1915 in not dissimilar circumstances there. So it was a great parallel in our family history. So whenever I'm there, I think of that. And when I'm talking about Anzio to groups, the subject of the Great War always comes in. You can never see any of these things in isolation. And I think that's really important in our understanding of both world wars. But not just that as well. When I moved on to Monte Cassino, and again, the conditions in Italy generally in the Second World War, it wasn't like Northwest Europe with a kind of rapid 11 months from D-Day to the end of the war in Germany. Italy was a long slog, the soft underbelly of the Third Reich, as Churchill had called it, and the tough old gut, as the men who fought there called it. And there were many, many occasions in the Italian campaign that had parallels to the Great War. And there were Great War veterans like Alexander, who commanded 15 Army Group, who fought there. He'd fought as an officer in the Irish Guards in the Great War. But about 20 years ago, I had the great pleasure to make several trips with my old pal John Dray. And if you listen to this podcast regularly, you'll have heard John Dray's name before. And I'd like to thank Neil Russell, one of the listeners, who very kindly, on a couple of occasions recently, has gone off the beaten track in Devon to find a few shadows of John's past for me. The sign on John's house, the plot of land that he had registered officially as Mametz after the lads of the 8th and 9th Devonshire Regiment who took part in the attack on Mametz on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. John lived in the village of Lusley, and lads from the village fought in that attack. So he wanted to do this, being a great war enthusiast, a great war nut, passionate about the Great War, whatever we're going to call it. He wanted to do that as his kind of mark on the landscape, and it's still there. And Neil very kindly took a photograph of that. But connecting into Italy and John's own service there, but his wider family, his brother had served with the Long Range Desert Group in the North African campaign and then the SAS, and took part in some of the raids on the Italian coast. And John's brother's buried in the cemetery at Lusley with the winged dagger badge of the SAS on his grave, and Neil very kindly popped in there to photograph that for me. This is one of the things I really like about this podcast, the community that we have around it, from the comments that you send me on Twitter and Facebook and all the other places. And when we chat in our community evenings that we have via Zoom. And I think it's really important because we're all kind of connected to the Great War. We have that in common. We are, just as John was, passionate about it. And I always think of him when I tramp the battlefields of the First World War and the stories he told me and the times that we were there together, both on our own trips, and John worked in my original team of Ledger Battlefield Guides in 1997, and the times we worked together. Me and John walked the Somme on our Walk in the Somme tour on many, many occasions, and it was a real privilege to have done that with him. But being back at Monte Cassino this week, I was looking across to a position in front of the monastery of Monte Cassino, through the windows of the monastery, out towards a position known as Snake's Head Ridge. And that's where John was with the 5th Battalion, the Northamptonshire Regiment. And when we went up there on the trips that we made in the early 2000s, he was a very good speaker. He was very good at describing his war, and in many respects almost had total recall of it. And he'd never been back to Snake's Head since the war. And it really kind of opened up so many memories for him. And it was very much a parallel to the experience that I'd had a generation before talking to the veterans of the Great War. And when we stood up there, because of his interest in the First World War, John described the conditions and the position that Snake's Head in that First World War context, because he knew it's something that I would understand. And there was this strong parallel. They lived not in trenches there, but sangars, circular stone positions, which they sheltered behind. They couldn't move in the daylight hours, could only come out at night. The enemy raided them, they raided the enemy. There were fixed line positions, and the same old stuff that we've often spoken about in this podcast with the Great War, the arrival of posts, the arrival of food and rations and equipment, and the chance to have a rest behind the lines was all part of their experience. And just like the veterans of the Great War that I interviewed in the 1980s and 90s, John and the hundreds and hundreds, I mean, I have no idea how many Second World War veterans I've spoken to, but those of men and women have given me an opportunity to phrase the history of the Second World War in the same kind of way that I talk to you here about the Great War. And that was heavily on my mind as I travelled around these battlefields in Italy last week. But we're going to move back to the Great War now and back to the core of what this podcast is about. And we're heading off once more this week to the Somme battlefields to connect up some of the places that we've done before. And I think this is important with the podcast episodes, that we can connect them up so you can have a wider context of parts of these battlefields. So this episode begins on the edge of La Boisselle. It goes up into Pozières, and there is a Pozières episode and a La Boisselle to Contalmaison episode quite recently, which will connect into this as well. So it's time to put on our virtual boots, pick up our virtual pack, and head off to the battlefields of the Somme. So where are we as we begin this walk? We're just east of the village of La Boisselle, just outside Albert on the Somme battlefields. And in our previous walk in this area, we came out of the village and we passed a little track that went off to the left, a little fork in the road, where the road continues straight on to Contalmaison on a tarmacked road. There's a track that goes off to the left. And we've followed that track out into the open fields between La Boisselle and beyond it, the rising ground of the Pozières Ridge and Pozières itself. And this ground was reached after the capture of La Boisselle in the early stage of the Battle of the Somme in July of 1916. Now, as we discussed in the previous podcast, this ground should have been taken on the 1st of July, on the first day of the battle, when the men of the 34th Division, the Tynesiders, supported by other units, should have advanced through here, pushed on towards the Pozières Ridge, other units passed through them, and the same old idea of the German infrastructure beyond by nightfall, who knows where by Christmas. I won't say Berlin because that sounds too much like Blackadder. But in terms of what happened here, the reality, of course, on the first day of the Somme was very, very different, and the 34th Division suffered catastrophic casualties in the fighting and got a mere foothold in and around La Boisselle. The 19th Western Division then moved in, and in the village itself, as we discovered in that previous podcast, there is a memorial both to them and the 34th. And they then captured the village, and a new line was established just east of it, facing towards Pozières, and beyond that, just to the southeast, the village of Contalmaison. That's where we are now. So in a time frame period, we've reached the second week, if you like, of the Battle of the Somme. And the ground that we're going to walk in this virtual walk along the battlefields of Picardy covers the period from July through to September 1916 and involves the story of British units, Australians, and finally, beyond that, of course, Canadians in the advance on Corps Selects, and it's that area that we'll reach. But where we are now is overlooking a bit of ground where there was a sad incident. There are so many sad incidents in the Battle of the Somme, but this was one involving a battalion of the British Army, the 13th Battalion of the Rifle Brigade. And I thought about this recently when I went down to Winchester for a few days, and I went into the old Peninsula Barracks at Winchester to visit the Green Jackets Museum, a really superb regimental museum, and a big shout out to them. Fantastic First World War displays in there, and beyond that as well, magnificent Waterloo model and all sorts of other gear. And the barracks themselves, which are now houses, is very interesting to walk round as well. They date back to the 19th century, and there's probably some older buildings there as well. And you can imagine in an area that's now a park, battalions of the Rifle Brigade and the King's Royal Rifle Corps on parade in places like this. So it made me think about the Rifle Brigade and the 13th Battalion. Now, well, why the 13th Battalion? Well, it ties into this location, but we know a lot about them because of two reasons, really. One, that they had a very good old comrades association that led to the publication of a battalion history for the duration that was published in April 1932 and written by D.H. Rowlands. It's a really, really good battalion history. Some of these battalion or unit histories can be a bit dry, and in many respects sometimes are not much more than a transcript of the unit's war diary. But Rowlands was a good writer, and the book was written in an accessible way, and it's about human stories as much as the military side of it, which is one of the things I think that drew me to it. I picked my copy up in a second-hand bookshop in one of these places like Eastbourne or Worthing that I've often spoken about in this podcast. And you can tell how long I've had it because the price inside was £1. Of course, you can get the book in its original format from book dealers like Tom Donovan. He's someone that I buy far too many Great War books from, but Naval and Military Press have reprinted it, so it's not a difficult book to get a hold of. And I'll look to see if it's on Amazon, and I'll put a link to that onto the podcast website for you, oldfrontline.co.uk. The 13th Battalion of the Rifle Brigade, they didn't have a title or anything like that, but they were formed one of many battalions of the Rifle Brigade and the King's Royal Rifle Corps, those two regiments that we associate with the Green Jackets, were both units that formed large numbers of battalions in the Great War. And the 13th Rifle Brigade was formed at Winchester in October 1914. It remained at the Rifle Brigade depot for a while and then moved on to training elsewhere. It became part of the 37th Division eventually, which was the English division whose monument is at Monchy-le-Preux, where they were fighting in 1917. Rowland's book on the battalion has a dedication on the flyleaf when you open it up, and it says, "Dedicated to the 768 gallant comrades who perished in the war and to those others who have since died." Now that in itself is quite an unusual entry. There's often a reference to the glorious dead, but the returning soldiers, the men who survived, the forgotten survivors of the Great War coming home and dying in the post-war period, that isn't something that you often see in a book like this. This came out in 1932. So there'd been more than a dozen years since the end of the Great War, and many men returned home with crippling wounds, suffered with those wounds. It shortened their lives. We mentioned John Drey in the introduction. John's dad wounded three times in the Great War, at Loos, at the Somme, at Trones Wood, and on the 31st of July 1917 on the Bellewarde Ridge at the beginning of Third Ypres. He died when John was only 12. So it's one of those things, I think, that you don't see in a book like this normally, that gives you an insight into where men like Rowlands, who publish works like this, were sometimes coming from. It wasn't just about the dead, it was about the men who came back as well. And in his author's notes to the book, Roland said, "This is a true story. It concerns the life of an infantry battalion whose members enlisted for the duration of the Great War. It is the chronicle of a service battalion of a famous regiment, yet it may be that some of its pages tell the history, at least in part, of other units of the British Army during those eventful years 1914 to 1918. The main theme is based on the official records of the 13th Battalion of the Rifle Brigade, and all the incidents described in the narrative really happened. The anecdotes and the personal impressions have been written from actual experience, some of it mine, some the experience of my battalion friends, with the aid of private notes and a good memory. It does not pretend to give a picture of the kind drawn by certain war films and novels, because there has been no attempt here to obtain effect at the expense of veracity, nor does it portray the life of the men in the trenches as one of brutality, profane language, and license. Should the dates and names seem tedious to the general reader, I can only offer the excuse that they are naturally of great personal interest to the surviving members of the battalion." So this book, For the Duration, is a bit of a gem, and this is from the opening chapter that describes the formation of the 13th Rifle Brigade, and it could really be the formation of so many units of Kitchener's army, the New Army, in 1914. It's called Soldiers in the Making. Day after day in the late summer of 1914, hundreds of men pressed up the high street of the ancient city of Winchester to the arch west gate and the rifle depot. All sorts and conditions of men, navvies, stockbrokers, artisans, clerks, miners, golf professionals, artists, students, they besieged the barrack square and waited long hours until the harassed staff could enroll them. At last they were sorted out, and some of them eventually became the 13th Service Battalion of the Rifle Brigade, a unit which was destined to gain great distinction on the battlefields of France and Flanders. So great was the crush of recruits that the facilities at the depot proved totally inadequate. The dining rooms, which had always been models of military neatness, were now cluttered with the remnants of meals served in relays on half-washed plates. Large batches of men were sent out to sleep, some on the floor of the old Corn Exchange, some in the Red Cross Hospital, pending the arrival of wounded from the front, some in a hostel patriotically provided by the Countess of Northbrook. Regular army instructors began at once to make soldiers of us in the crowded barrack square. In little groups we learned to salute, to mark time, to form fours, to about turn without falling over our feet, and also to double round Winchester before breakfast without losing our wind. We couldn't see the point of these elementary details. We wanted to get on with the war. It was not until our disorderly mob was beginning to develop into a disciplined crowd that the whole value of this preliminary training slowly dawned upon us. We had a great many things to learn, and not the least difficult was how to learn who was and was not entitled to our respectful salutes, so that we brought the right hand up smartly whenever we encountered an important personage, from the colonel to the sergeant major. The colonel was Lieutenant Colonel C.F. Pretor Pinney. He served as commanding officer of the battalion from its formation until he died of wounds in the Battle of Arras in 1917. He was aged 50 when he died, so he wasn't a young man. He'd served previously in the army, and he came from quite a wealthy background, having houses in both Suffolk and Chelsea. He'd been educated at Cambridge and then gone to Sandhurst. After a time in Winchester, the battalion moved to High Wycombe and then Salisbury Plain to become, as Rowlands calls it, pucker soldiers, proper soldiers. And then from there they moved to France with the 37th Division, that unit comprised of all those English county battalions and regiments. In July of 1915 they went across to the Western Front into a quiet sector close to the town of Armentières, home of the famous Mademoiselle, in that sector which was a bit of a nursery sector for units coming to the front and learning about the day-to-day activities of trench warfare. In September 1915, they moved down to the Gommecourt sector, just north of the main Somme area, and held the ground around Monchy-au-Bois, not to be confused with Monchy-le-Preux, Arras. Monchy-au-Bois was a village just north of Gommecourt, between the Somme area and Arras. This was another quiet sector. where they'd been fighting with the French in the early period of the war. British troops then took over this sector. And during this period, this was the move for British troops extending the British sector of the Western Front, with the Battle of Loos taking place up around northern France, around Lens and Loos, of course. Then in this area, we began to move units down to the Somme for preparations to take over this part of the battlefield as well. And in villages like Bienvillers, which was behind their lines, and Monchy, unit after unit from the 37th Division rotated through here. And we've got quite a lot of accounts of this from different people. And my old veteran pal, Malcolm Vivian, who I've mentioned quite a few times in this, who was a gunner officer, forward observer in 96 Siege Battery, Royal Garrison Artillery, he was here during that period as well, spotting for his guns, which were behind the lines on the other side of the village of Bienvillers, dropping down shells onto the German positions around Gommecourt and the line just north of there, before he then moved down to take part in the bombardment around Gommecourt to the south in the 56th London Division sector in the beginning of the Battle of the Somme. The 13th Rifle Brigade, as indeed their whole division did, stayed in this sector until the beginning of the Somme offensive. They were in the next army area. They were not in the 4th Army at that stage. They were outside of that area, but part of the same army that did the Gommecourt diversionary attack when the 46th Division and the 56th London Division attacked the villages there. They were in reserve just to the north. But as the offensive, particularly its heavy losses on the first day, moved forward and there was a necessity to move down fresh troops to continue with the attack, on the 6th of July 1916, the battalion marched down from that area to the north to the town of Albert to move up to take part in the Battle of the Somme. Now, our other account of the 13th Rifle Brigade comes much later in terms of the historiography, and it comes from Lynn MacDonald. This was Lynn MacDonald's favourite battalion. She interviewed quite a few of the surviving veterans of the 13th Rifle Brigade who were still around in the 70s and the 80s. And when she wrote her Somme book that came out in 1983, she included quite a lot of material from the 13th Battalion men. And it's really good to read that. And again, I'll put a link to Lynn MacDonald's Somme book on the podcast website. In particular, one of those of us that were privileged to meet these veterans, we had what we called favourite veterans. And I remember her saying once that Jack Cross, who was a veteran of the 13th Rifle Brigade, was one of hers, and he figures heavily in that book. One of those that she spoke to was Roland himself, who had written the book, who was alive when she began her period of interviewing veterans, and he gave additional accounts of his service that differ slightly, or perhaps enhance what is in the book. And this is his account of coming down to the Somme. "I can see us now, a long column of marching riflemen. We must have recaptured our high spirits of the night before, because we were singing again. It was a fair step, and the gaps between the platoons got noticeably wider and wider. We marched past a field gun battery, halted for tea. We could have done with a cup ourselves, and we let them know it as we went by. Then we marched past them up a steep bit of road, and as we got to the top of the rise, there were long stretches of canvas fastened to plane trees along the roadside to hide the traffic on the road from enemy observation, and beyond the hill, we could see the town of Albert down in the valley. It was funny how the singing died away. Shells were bursting away to the northeast, and there in front of us was Albert, looking fairly intact, but with the battered cathedral tower standing out above it, and the figure of the Virgin holding the child leaning over the town in this sorrowful attitude. I can still picture that stark outline in my mind's eye, and it seemed to me then, as it always did afterwards when I looked back on it, that she seemed to be lamenting the folly of men." So having moved out of Albert, they took over the trenches, the positions just taken from the Germans around the village of La Boisselle in the area where we're standing on this track. And a new attack, a continuation of the offensive, was planned for the 10th of July 1916. This was a two-battalion attack with the 13th Rifle Brigade in the lead and the 13th Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, in support. And while they were attacking this ground between Pozières and Contalmaison, units from another division, the Yorkshire Regiment, the Greenhowes, were attacking directly the village of Contalmaison itself. The final orders came down to the command post where Lieutenant Colonel Pretor Pinney was, and they stated that they would be supported in this attack by a very strong barrage. So duly at 0 hour on the 10th of July 1916, the battalion went over the top. Jack Cross, Lynn MacDonald's favourite veteran, is quoted in her book with the following description of the attack. "We impressed upon the chaps in the platoon, don't stick together, don't bunch, keep apart. If you bunch up, they'll pick you off like rabbits. I was on the left of my platoon, on one side of the tramway, and Sergeant Laney was on my left on the other side, because he was the right-hand man of No. 11 platoon. It was only about 100 yards or maybe 150 yards in front of us, the first German trench, and we'd got to go straight ahead and capture that position. The whistle went, and away they went. As soon as they did, you could hear the bullets whistling. I yelled at Laney, 'Look at that lot going through there.' There was a gap in the wire, and the platoon in front of us converged on it and into the gap. They went down, just like that. I should think every man was mortally wounded." But despite these losses, they got a foothold in the German positions. But looking around him, the commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Pinney, suddenly realised that they were on their own, that the 13th Royal Fusiliers were not supporting them, and the barrage was nowhere near as strong as been promised. There was no artillery support. Men were falling. No support battalion. It was just them, the 13th Rifle Brigade, exposed and in the open. Ahead of them, the German positions were organised around a defended sunken lane. The Germans had good fields of fire, and beyond that there was a deep valley leading up towards Pozieres where their field guns were located, and very quickly they brought down retaliatory fire to this attack. It was clear to the commanding officer that the whole attack was hanging in the balance. What had happened? What could have been racing through his mind at that point, seeing all this unfold before him? In a shell hole in no man's land, while he was contemplating this, a runner arrived and had caught up with both the battalion and, it's more importantly, its commanding officer. He delivered a message, attack cancelled. The message had reached everyone except the lead battalion, 13th Rifle Brigade. Now, there could be many reasons for this. Runners could have been shot, could have been hit by shrapnel, artillery fire. The casualties amongst runners, as we know from the movie 1917, were high. So these messages delivered by men to forward positions didn't always make it through, and they certainly didn't in this case. And the battalion had gone over the top with an attack that had been cancelled. So there was no support, there was no artillery barrage. They were literally there on their own. And now the colonel had to extract his battalion under the eyes of the enemy in direct fire from it. With no radio communications, he couldn't just get on the blower and call the men back. He too had to send out runners to the platoon and the company commanders to pass on these messages. The battalion was still fighting in the German positions around the sunken lane, but it was very exposed now. Corporal Joe Hoyle's MM of the 13th Battalion is quoted in Lynn MacDonald's book, "Every officer was wounded or killed. We only had one officer left, Captain Riviere, and he shouted across to me, 'Corporal, gather some men together and capture that machine gun post that's doing the damage.' We went up this German communication trench and we found this machine gun. There were only about six of us left in the section, and I went ahead, and when I saw the Boche there round the corner, I said, 'Right, lads, get rid of your bombs,' and over went the bombs. We killed those poor chaps, we captured one prisoner alive, I sent him back, and just with that, we had the order to retire. It was about 10 o'clock by then, just getting dusk, and after all that massacre, after we'd taken the trenches, we had to retire." Dusk did indeed allow that shattered battalion to withdraw from the battlefield. Most officers had been killed, wounded, or were missing. Four company commanders were casualties, most of them dead. The regimental medical officer had been killed as well, which meant that the evacuation of the wounded, the whole process of that, had broken down. With no one supporting them and the RMO, the regimental medical officer, killed, that meant the evacuation of the wounded by stretcher bearers was not going to points where they'd be picked up. So the whole process was really broken at this stage, and that no doubt increased the pressure on the medical services that were there and sadly resulted in many soldiers dying of their wounds. And because they had made it into the positions around the sunken lane, into the German trenches, they'd left behind a lot of their dead and a lot of their wounded who couldn't be moved. So there were many, many missing soldiers after this attack. Lieutenant Colonel Pretor Pinney himself had been evacuated to an advanced dressing station, and he was found there by one of the soldiers in tears, saying, "What a mess they've made of my battalion. What a mess they've made of my battalion. A broken man, really, as a consequence of it. When men go into battle, they know there is a chance they'll always fall, but they like to see some results for the toil and for the sacrifice they've made. In this attack, that was hard to find, and Roland in the battalion history called it the tragic summer of 1916. Total casualties in the battalion were 20 officers and 380 men, which was the majority of the officers and about half of the soldiers who had gone over the top that day. In For the Duration, Rowlands wrote, "When the battalion had returned from its terrible experience, there came to the mind of each survivor a cynical and lasting impression of the true significance of modern warfare. Men stood in little groups, brooding on the tragedy and caring not what happened next. Many still wore an ashen grey look, their eyes revealing a half-demented mind. More than one was pondering on the fate of a loved brother, perhaps still alive out there in some ditch filled with dead comrades." And so here, as we stand on this track looking out across this ground where the 13th Rifle Brigade went into that attack in July 1916, we're looking towards the sunken lane, which we'll walk up ourselves later in this walk. Few people can ever come down here, but it's one of those corners of the Somme where in a tragic battlefield the tragedy seems even more intense than usual. And we're lucky, really, that it's so documented through the battalion history by Rowlands and the work of Lynn MacDonald in her Somme book. And it's worth reading that chapter of the book to get a greater insight into what happened here in 1916. We'll then return our way down the track to the La Boisselle-Contal Maison Road, and we'll go left there and walk along the road. Over to our right, we'll see Gordon Dump Cemetery that we visited in the previous walk in this area, and we'll carry straight on into a part of the road where gradually it gets surrounded by trees. The trees here were planted on this part of the battlefield in the early 2000s and now become quite a big area of woodland, alive with birdsong at different points in the year. But the road gets sunken here until a point where it meets a crossroads of roads and tracks in a sunken part of it. And this was known as Casualty Corner, and this will be our next stop. We've come down into the sunken part of the road between La Boisselle and Contal Maison, and it's surrounded by this area of planted trees, planted in recent times. There used to be a small farm to the left of this road, and for many years it was abandoned, and someone bought the ground and used it to create a new area of woodland. Some aspects of the battlefields do change. I'd see this one as a positive one in the way that encourages wildlife, but of course it does change the landscape from its 1916 or Great War perspective. But one thing that doesn't change here is the way this road is sunken, and it comes down to this point where the road goes ahead towards Contal Maison and a track comes from the right and a track goes off to the left. Now, this was known during the war as Casualty Corner because following the advance as it moved forward with the capture of Contal Maison and the fighting around Pozières, casualties were evacuated back down through here and then taken to the casualty clearing stations in Albert and indeed beyond. So this was a main route for soldiers with serious wounds coming back from the different attacks. It would have been a hive of activity during the Battle of the Somme. Later, as the fighting moved forward again, so as the Australians pushed forward through Pozières and the Canadians took over for the fighting at Courcelette, Canadian units would come from Albert, from the brickfields north of the town, down through the town and out along this route and up into the sector around Courcelette for the later fighting beyond the village and up towards Regina Trench, and then other units fighting beyond Contal Maison towards the Horseshoe of Woods around Bazentin, beyond that High Wood, came up through this route as well. And towards the end of the Battle of the Somme, when the front lines were up on the La Transloy Ridge and across to the Butte de Warlencourt, units coming back from the front line there and going up to the front line there used this route as well. And there is some archive film of Australians in that cold winter of 1916-17 using this road going to and from the front. We turn left here onto the track that goes up towards Pozières village. It was known during the war as Dead Man's Road because I suspect there was a dead of both sides here until they were properly buried, perhaps some from the 13th Rifle Brigade attack, because we're coming into the sunken lane that formed part of the German defences here, and perhaps some of the German defenders. And as the Australians made their advance up through here towards Pozieres, no doubt some of their dead too. At different points along the sunken road, you can stop and look to your left, back towards the track where we were in the fields outside the village of La Boisselle, and get a German view of the ground over which the 13th Rifle Brigade advanced, and see what a field of fire the Germans had from these positions, exposed and open. The 13th Rifle Brigade on its own didn't really stand much of a chance there. But one thing that you come up to on the right-hand side is a bunker. Now, this is not a big German concrete structure like Gibraltar was up in Pozieres itself. This is almost certainly a British bunker. How do we know that? There is some very good books about bunkers in the First World War, but even just standing here, you can tell immediately because the door is facing towards Albert. So that means any shell coming from the direction of Albert, i.e. from the original positions held by the British Army, would have gone straight through the front door, straight into the bunker and killed or wounded everybody inside. So when the Germans, if they'd have built this, it would have been on the other side of the sunken lane with the door facing away from Albert, so that shells didn't come in through the front door like that. So it's likely that this was built, and you remember that the crossroads back where we've come from was called Casualty Corner. It's likely that this was part of the casualty evacuation arrangements here, because it's when you go inside it, and you can for most months of the year, I mean, I haven't been there since pre-COVID, but you can get inside it. It's a mixture of concrete and brick line. It's pretty big, and you can imagine stretcher cases being brought in there for treatment when it was raining or when it was raining shells. So I would guess that it's probably part of that. So it could have been a military foot police bunker used for them to shelter in when they were controlling the traffic around Casualty Corner and on the road, that vital route to and from the front line between the rear echelon around Albert and the front lines wherever they were at different points in the battle. It wasn't uncommon for this kind of infrastructure to be put in place for the military foot police to go about their business. As a bunker near Hellfire Corner at Ypres that was built for that purpose as well. This bunker I didn't know was here until Lynn MacDonald's book came out in 1983. And I remember reading about it in there, and she puts a photograph of it. And when I next had a chance to go over, scrabbled around with some friends, and we found it here. And one friend, a collector of militaria, walked up to the bunker and pulled a British bayonet out of the bank just by the side of it. Whether that had been used to pin down some telephone wire or something else, who knows? But it was this great kind of connection to the fact that troops had once occupied this position. Those days in the 80s on the Somme, this kind of artifact was everywhere. Helmets in the corner of fields, bayonets, rifles, and all sorts of other paraphernalia just lying around. A lot less common these days. And of course, with professional battlefield conflict archaeology going on, what do we do when we find it? Should we just leave it? Leave it for future archaeologists? Or is there so much of it that we can pick it up? I mean, I don't have an answer to this. It's hard not to pick it up. I'd be perfectly honest and say that, but it is part of the archaeological record. But the battlefields here are so vast, so dense, so in depth, and there's so much material here. Where do you stop? Legions of archaeologists could be working here for all time almost. Maybe they should be. Again, I'll leave you to make that decision. But this bunker is an important British bunker of the Battle of the Somme. There aren't that many British bunkers from the period of the battle in this area that you can just go into or come up to like this, and it's worth having a little walk up here to come and have a look at it next time you're over. Sunken lanes like this were always dug into on one bank or other. It's likely that the Germans had dugouts on the left-hand side, perhaps not concrete or brick-lined, but they definitely would have had them here. The valleys in and around the sunken lane where we are were certainly used by German artillery before the Battle of the Somme, and then later on as the offensive moved forward, British artillery would have come into the same valleys, and Australian guns and Canadian guns as the fighting moved into Pozieres and Courcelette, and there would have been other dugouts. This one survives because it was so well built. The others have collapsed in on themselves and they were sealed up. There was a period in the early 20s when the French government went round filling in or sealing up these bunkers and these dugouts in places like this because it was believed they were being used for smuggling for contraband goods. This is reported in quite a few of those interwar books that talk about battlefield pilgrimage and how the battlefields were changing. And just as clearing up the battlefields of artifacts and barbed wire and filling in the shell holes, these kind of subterranean positions offered their own kind of problems to the people in the post-war world, and continue to this day, because there's been a lot of development, even on the Somme, which remains one of the more open landscapes, still retaining most of its kind of geography and not affected in the way that development has affected the ground around Ypres, for example. But even so, when things have been dug, they've been built on top of dugout systems that people don't even know is there, and you can see cracks in the walls of modern houses which really shouldn't be there. The nature of the ground of the whole Somme battlefield, pulverised by shellfire and probably never really suitable to build anything of any size on again, although they've had a pretty good go at it with one or two factory units and logistics hubs, particularly up towards Bapaume in recent years. If you come into the Somme via Bapaume, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a massive, great big structure been put there, dwarfing a wartime bunker that was just on the edge of the approach to the village of Gravilliers. Continuing along the track, we come nearer to the village of Pozières, and we can see Pozières sitting on the ridgeline, the high ground. This is its importance, really. Pozières sits on this high point, some of the highest features on the Somme 1916 battlefield, dominating this central part of the battlefield area, why the Allies were keen to take it and why the Germans were keen to defend it. And we're coming into Pozières from the direction the Australian attacks came in the assault on the village. A little bit further up, we come to a quarry known as the Chalk Pit in the Australian accounts of the fighting here in July to September of 1916. This was also used as a headquarters, and there would have been dugouts in this area for sure. Battalion headquarters, medical facilities had their positions here, and the Australians used it as their main headquarters post for units that were fighting in and around the village and over towards the German defences in what was called the OG lines, the old German lines. Post-war, the quarry seems to have been used as a dumping point for ordnance, for shells and grenades and ammunition that had been found and cleared from the surrounding battlefield. I picked up a collection of photographs from a soldier who'd served with the Imperial War Graves Commission just after the war in one of the graves registration units. And he took a whole load of photographs of the Somme area at that time, one of which is a massive, massive pile of Granatenwerfer, German trench mortar bombs, Mills grenades, high explosive, machine gun ammunition, helmets, all sorts of gear that were in this quarry awaiting disposal, whether for scrap or being blown up in the case of the ordnance. And I know a couple of local collectors in the area also used it as a place if they found a shell which they were looking to deactivate, and believe me, there were plenty of people who did this, and make that part of their collection. They would often bring it to here, leave it here, and then come back and do it another day, or they would dump shells here that they couldn't deactivate because they knew they had gas in and it was unsafe to do that. I mean, this is a mindset that often we find difficult to understand, but there were collectors here who were pretty convinced that they were able to do this kind of stuff, and they did it. And one of them told me a story once how he found a particularly rare large caliber shell, and I can't recall whether it was German or British, but it doesn't really matter. He brought it into this quarry, and he deactivated it in two stages, soaking it in petrol to loosen up the fuse on the top of the shell, and then unscrewing that and taking that off, and then exposing the charge inside, and then he'd kind of bury it and burn it, set fire to it to try and burn out the explosive. And that was a risky business because the fire could obviously cause the shell to explode. Even taking the fuse out was not a desperately brilliant idea because there could be some residue of the explosive that had weeped into the grooves of where the shell fuse was screwed in. And unscrewing it, even with petrol in there, you were essentially taking one type of metal with explosive in the middle and another type of metal and grinding the explosive between two pieces of metal, which is not a good idea either. Anyway, the fuse was taken off, the shell was buried, set fire to, and he went off into Albert to do his shopping. And as he was driving back up the Albert-Bapaume Road, back up towards Pozières, he saw a massive flame suddenly erupt from the quarry where the shell had indeed caught and had lifted itself upwards as the flame had shot out the end of the shell. The explosive had burnt, caught fire, and the flame had come out, and the shell lifted upwards and the flame shot straight up in the air for all to see, including the local gendarmes. So he didn't go back there, and he didn't go back there for quite some time to keep well away from that and make sure there was no connection between him and that incident. So this is something, of course, which we would highly recommend that you do not do under any circumstances, but it shows that in the old days on the Somme, the old generation who'd been here all their lives, some of them back to that interwar period, believed not only were they a bit invincible with this stuff, that they knew how to dispose of it and then clear it, clean it, and bring it into their collections. And indeed, there were many collections on the Somme formed from this deactivating, in inverted commas, ordnance that was found in and around the battlefield area. So from the quarry, we move up into the outskirts of Pozières village, following the direction of the Australian attack here on the 23rd of July 1916, as they moved up into the village. Pozières fell to them very, very quickly, within a day. That was the easy bit, and they attacked not from where British troops had attacked to the west, but from the southwest and coming up in that direction that we've just walked on this route. Got into the village, fought their way through the rubble of Pozières, because even in those first weeks of the battle, Pozières on its high point had been bombarded and smashed to oblivion by the artillery bombardments. And as the Australians came into the village, ahead of them was the huge concrete structure of the Gibraltar bunker, again which we visited in the very first podcast we ever did with the Old Front Line. And that was named after the Rock of Gibraltar because of its big size, the way it looked and stuck in this prominent position on this part of the battlefield. Not anything to do with Hanoverian soldiers who have the cuff title Gibraltar on their uniforms. It had nothing to do with them. That's what it was named after, was the Rock of Gibraltar. There was fighting in and around there, fighting within the houses and the cellars of the village, but the Australians cleared this and pushed to the far side. That was the easy bit. Beyond the village, on the left flank, was Ferme de Mouquet, Mucky Farm or Mucow Farm, although I was reading recently how perhaps Australian soldiers didn't actually call it by that name during the war. It's interesting how some of these names develop. And then over to the right, towards the crest of the Pozières Ridge, was the OG lines, the old German lines, these two distinct and defined lines of defence built around the site of the Pozières windmill. That, both those positions, the farm and the OG lines and the Pozières windmill site, took much longer for the Australians to capture, and along the way suffering heavy casualties. And one of the features of the Pozières battle, when you look at the maps after the Australians had taken it, was the way that it sat in a bit of a salient, with Thiepval and Mouquet Farm to the north, with the positions around Courcelette and further down the Albert-Papon Road to the northeast and roughly the east, and then the other positions as yet untaken over towards Highwood in that area, Martinpuy, to the east. So it meant that the Germans could fire into the Australian positions here from a lot of different angles, and knowing the importance of its high position on the battlefield, it was an area that saw a huge amount of artillery activity and was vaporized really almost by the bombardments here in 1916. So you can imagine it's done that to the structures, the buildings, the church, the houses, the farms. You can imagine what it was doing to the Australian soldiers on the ground. So there's a very high proportion of missing soldiers in the Australian Imperial Force in their engagement here at Pozières in 1916. Now, we walked around the edge of the village in the previous podcast on Pozières. We're going to turn right here and go straight down the Albert-Bapaume Road. We'll pass along the way the Latomy Bar, owned by Dominic Zanardi, a great character, big collector, fantastic collection in his cafe there, reconstructed trenches out the back, good place to have a drink and some lunch or some dinner, highly recommended. I've known Dominic for many, many years when he used to have a private museum in his house, and then he opened up a little place in Albert near to one of the shopping centres in the 1980s, and then he became the first curator of the Musée des Abris, as it was in those days, the Somme Museum in Albert, and then later he bought the Pozières Café from the Brie family in Pozières, who ran it for many, many years, and then opened up Latomy and has been here ever since. Dominic's done a lot of work over the years to help recover the dead. When farmers find bodies, often Dominic is the one they come to first, and then he then speaks to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission or the Volksbund, if it's a German, and these soldiers are recovered. So he's done a lot of good work in ensuring that missing soldiers are recovered and properly buried, and in many cases identified as well. And from here, we'll follow past the cafe, going down the full length of the village It's rebuilt now. There are some new houses here. There's a lot of 1920s buildings. A village completely destroyed, as we've said, rebuilt, typical of so many villages on the Somme in 1916. And at the far end of the village, just as we reach the water tower, that'll be our next stop. We're standing in front of the water tower, the Château d'Eau, on the edge of the village of Pozières. And this is the water tower that was built in the interwar period to pump fresh water out of a fissure to supply water to the houses in the village. It's still in use today, but they've painted it since the centenary and put a figure of an Australian soldier, a face of an Australian soldier on there, and the Australian cap badge, the rising sun, and also details of the Victoria Crosses that were awarded to men in and around the village of Pozières. Unsurprisingly, most of them Australian, but one British soldier, Billy Short of the Greenhounds, the Yorkshire Regiment, who got his Victoria Cross in the fighting near Munster Alley on the far side of the village from where we are at the moment. And a Canadian as well. The Canadians moved in after the Australians had taken Pozières and the ground around it. And before the attack on Courcelette, the Canadians took part in some minor actions around the village, and one of those involved the 2nd Battalion Canadian Infantry, who took part of the German trenches to the southern side of the Pozières windmill site on the 9th of September 1916, and a party of bombers in that battalion, led by Corporal Leo Clark, who came from a street in Winnipeg where three men from that street would be awarded the Victoria Cross. He went into action, and during the fighting there, for his gallantry, he was one of those three men awarded the VC. He went on to fight, promoted to sergeant, went on to fight in Courcelette and the battles towards Regina Trench, where he was wounded, evacuated down, and he died of wounds on the French coast and is buried near Le Havre. So those are the five Victoria Cross recipients, three Australian, Billy Short from the British and Leo Clark from the Australians. And I think what it shows is the connection the people of Pozières have got to the Great War. A lot of these communities on the battlefields are connected to it. They have their own ceremonies. On national days of remembrance in France, they go down very often to the local British and Commonwealth cemeteries and lay a wreath. Or you see local people in those cemeteries all the time and signing the visitor's book. And that engagement with the Great War and their landscape can only be a positive thing. Now, the busy modern world thunders by at this location, and we're going to walk down the street, down the road now, towards the crest of the Pozières Ridge here, to the windmill site. Now, before the Great War, to the left-hand side of the road here was a towered windmill made out of stone. There's some photographs of it in some of the German books on the Great War, the An der Somme, the photo books that were published during the conflict. And I'll put a couple of those on the podcast website so you can see what it once looked like. What it later looked like when the Australians and Canadians were here was just this lunar landscape of shell craters. And this position, being on a high point, had two defensive trench lines around it, which the Australians called OG1 and OG2. OG standing for Old German Line, so Old German Line 1, Old German Line 2. Now, why they used that phrase, Old German, I don't really know, because these trenches weren't that old, and they were part of the in-depth defences the Germans had built in this particular sector. But that's the name they gave them. It was a strong position. When you stand here and look back towards Pozières, and you can see the ground around you. In fact, on this particular spot here, you can see both ends of the Somme battlefield. You can look to the north and follow the electric pylons up towards Gommecourt, and then go round the corner of the hedges where the radio mast is at the Pozières windmill site, and look to the south and see the church spire of Montauban. So Gommecourt at one end, Montauban at the other end. So today we can see an incredible distance, and the Germans obviously could do the same, certainly back to Albert from here with all the landscape smashed by artillery fire. And they defended it, and the Australians spent really most of their experience in the Battle of the Somme trying to take this ground, following the initial attacks in July, in the fighting in August, leading up to when eventually the Canadians moved in September of 1916. By then, the windmill was just a pile of rubble. The Germans had concreted some bits of it, and you can still see some of that concrete in the Australian 2nd Australian Division Memorial that sits on the site where the Pozières windmill was located. When I first used to come here, it was surrounded by a hedge. It had a little wooden gate and a fence, and you went down the path into it. A few years ago, they renovated the site. The gate's been removed, which is a bit of a shame because the gate was a wooden gate with a carved badge of the Australian Imperial Forces on it. And I suspect that was probably the original entrance that was placed there in the 1920s. I hope somewhere that may have been preserved. And there is a memorial in here, stone, Portland Stone Memorial, that records quite rightly that Australians fell more thickly on this battlefield than any other of the war. The Australians lost almost as many men at Pozieres in the July, August, September battles as they had done in the entire Gallipoli campaign of 1915. So it was a terrible cost that they paid here on the Somme to fight over and take this ground. And where the Australian 2nd Australian Division Memorial is located, it overlooks the ground where on the 4th of August 1916, units from that division made their attack on the OG lines and largely captured major chunks of them. Now, when I lived on the Somme, I attended quite a few reburials on the battlefields over those years, and one that happened in the village of Courcelettes at Courcelettes British Cemetery in 1998 was the reburial of Private Russell Bazisto. He was an Australian soldier who had been killed on this spot on the 4th of August 1916, posted missing. His name was on the Villers Breteneur Memorial. That's the Australian memorial to the missing that commemorates Australian soldiers who fell in France who have no known grave. I think something like half the dead, or maybe even more than half the dead, of the Australians killed at Pozieres in 1916 do not have a known grave. We were speaking earlier about the terrible bombardments that were here and the huge amount of artillery that was dropped onto this landscape, and it destroyed field graves and it destroyed bodies that were not buried, and that's why I think there were so many missing here. So the Villers Breteneur Memorial commemorated those who had no known grave, and like I say, very high proportion are Pozieres casualties. Russell Bazisto, from a small village in South Australia, was one of those. And in the 90s, a farmer who owned the grounds around this memorial was ploughing, as he ploughed many, many times, when his plough snagged in something and it snagged the body of Russell Bazisto. He was lying there, probably in the bottom of a shell hole, with a Lee Enfield rifle with his full equipment, and the equipment was made out of kangaroo hide, the leather equipment the Australians had. They couldn't produce enough webbing equipment and the British couldn't produce enough to send to them, so a copy of the webbing gear was made out of kangaroo hide and issued to Australian troops. It didn't have a massively good reputation. It was considered uncomfortable to wear compared to the webbing gear, but it was used by quite a lot of Australian units, particularly in the 2nd Australian Division. They'd served at the end of the Gallipoli campaign and then reformed in Egypt before they'd been sent off to the Western Front. So he was wearing this gear and it kind of held the body together, really. And more importantly, he had one of the early pattern Australian identity discs, which was a large aluminium disc, quite thick, and preserves very, very well in the chalky soil that the Somme has. And that gave his name, his details, and they were able to trace his descendants, who were still living, incredibly, in the same place. And I spoke to a member of the Australian Forces who went there to give them the news, and they went to the place where Bazisto had come from, and his name was on the war memorial, and they went to the house, and when they went in the house, there was a picture of Bazisto hanging on the hallway and in his uniform. So it was just one of this incredible kind of stories of closure, a soldier missing for all those decades, finally a knock at the door to report that he'd been found in a French field, and the family came over. And the battalion that he served with still existed within the Australian Forces today, and they came and attended the funeral and carried his coffin to Courcelette British Cemetery. And if you ever pop in there, you'll find his grave. His name is in the register, of course. You go in, he's over towards the right-hand plots of the cemetery at Courcelette. The area where Bazisto was found is now grassed over. There was a project here in and around the centenary period to turn this into an Australian memorial park. And at one stage when I came here in 2016, they'd planted white crosses in memory of all of the Australians who were missing at Pozieres, and laid out the line of where the OG line was across this bit of field. And that looked pretty good, quite interesting. I brought some groups here to have a look at it, but it's developed a bit beyond that. At one stage, I believe they were going to put up some kind of memorial wall where people could sponsor plaques. And there is a garden area now which has what I would politely describe as some pretty second-rate garden furniture in it, some rather odd statues. which I don't think really have a place in somewhere like this, where so many Australians paid the ultimate price to try and push Germany out of France and end the Great War and restore freedom to the people of France once more. I'm not sure this is a fitting memorial site as it is at the moment, and I hope it will change. Turning it into a park, marking the trench, recording the missing, that all seems pretty good to me. The rest of it, I'm not really so sure about. But whatever, the battlefields change. There are new memorials all the time. And that's not a bad thing, because it shows people still connect greatly with this subject. And that's what we want. We want the memory of the Great War to never be diminished. And for Australia in 1916, although Fromelles in northern France was their first battle on the Western Front, a few days later, the fighting here at Pozieres, this was their biggest battle of that year, their first big engagement in the trenches of the Western Front, a world very different, a battlefield very different to their experience at Gallipoli the previous year. And it's an important page in Australia's military history, and there's some very good books about this now, which, again, we'll put some indications to those on the podcast website. But the Australian Memorial is not the only one here, and this new park is not the only thing here as well. Another original memorial on the other side of the road is the Tank Corps Memorial, a white obelisk surrounded by four bronze models of First World War tanks, two of the rhombus-shaped Mark IV tanks that were used later in the war, a Whippet tank, which is a kind of reconnaissance tank in many respects, a faster tank that could move, again used in the final phase of the First World War, and an artillery tractor. And it's surrounded by fence posts, which are six-pounder gun barrels from the tanks, and the chain that was used to push the tracks around the rhombus shape that links them all up. It's an original site. It's the site chosen by the Tank Corps for their main Great War memorial. Why here and not elsewhere? Well, this was a forming up point for tanks that were used in the Battle of Fleurs-Courcelette. Here, the tanks that went into action supporting the Canadians in the assault on Courcelette village formed up in this area. I suspect they also chose it because it was on a main road and it could be easily visited. So this was the location chose to mark the Tank Corps. Now, subsequently, again, new memorials have marked their story up at Ypres in the village of Polkapel, and there is an original First World War tank to go and see in Flesquières, where the tanks were in 1917. But this is their main memorial, their original memorial, which Tank Corps veterans would have attended the ceremony, the opening ceremony of, and men came to in that period. And in the Second World War, it was on a route that ran between northern France and Normandy. It was strafed, this road, by United States Army Air Force and the RAF at different points. And I know from talking to locals that quite a lot of German vehicles were knocked out here, sending supplies and men down to the Normandy front once the D-Day invasion had taken place. And the memorial was hit. One of the tanks has a large caliber round from probably an American aircraft lodged in it, and the fence posts have indication of shrapnel or bullet damage on them as well. So it's a game where the paths of the First and the Second World War meet, as we were talking about in the opening of this podcast with visits to Anzio and Monte Cassino. Having visited the memorials, we can walk across that grassed area over towards the Pozieres-Courcelette Road. It's a minor road that runs at an angle down into the village. We have a couple of episodes dedicated to the fighting at Courcelette involving the Canadians. They took over from the Australians here in early September of 1916. And then on the 15th September, the Canadian Corps, commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Julian Byng, in its first engagement as an entire corps, made an assault against an enemy position to capture it. And Courcelette, the far end of this road, became the first French village liberated by Canadian troops in the 20th century, something that would then reverberate between the two world wars, if we think, for example, of the Canadian landings in Normandy in 1944. We can get a good sense of the landscape here, the way the ground drops away towards the village of Courcelette and then rises beyond it to where Regina Trench ran at the far end of the village. But that's a story for another day, and a story that we've covered in previous podcasts. There's a track that goes off of this road to our left, and we can follow that to where it does a 90-degree turn to the left, back towards the village of Pozieres. This area is where the OG1 and OG2 cuts across the corner of that track where it bends, and we're close to a position marked on the Australian maps as the elbow. So the shape of the track here very much kind of reflects that of an elbow, bent elbow. And there was intensive fighting here involving Australian troops in the summer of 1916. And we're very, very close to where Albert Jacka in the 14th Battalion Australian Infantry fought an action here in that summer, which could and perhaps should have resulted in the award of a bar to the Victoria Cross to Jacka. Jacka was the first Australian soldier to win the Victoria Cross in the Great War as an ordinary soldier at Gallipoli in 1915. He was then given a battlefield promotion and he continued to serve right up until the end of the conflict. The Battle of La Hamel in 1918 was one of his major final actions of the Great War. Here at Pozieres on the Western Front, Jacka kind of ramped up his approach to combat and fought, as many people have said, almost his own private war. His battalion was known as Jacka's Mob. And Edward Rule, who was an officer in the battalion, talks about how when they were marching down the road once and another Australian battalion went past them, they could hear them whispering, "There goes Jacka's Mob." And he says his spine tingled and the hairs stood up on the back of his neck to be associated with this fine soldier. He said it was such an honour. And Jacka was no doubt, he was one of the great heroes of the Australian forces in the Great War. A tough soldier, a rough soldier, a brave soldier and a dedicated soldier who believed in the Australian concept of mateship. And during the fighting here, he was cut off in a German trench and his men were down in a dugout and the Germans called down to them, "Surrender." And Jacka calmly handed out grenades and ammunition and they fought their way out of this dugout, out into the German trench, wiped out the Germans who were trying to take them prisoner, saw the Germans marching off some Australians towards Courcelette, I suspect, to take them prisoner, shot those Germans, released the Australians, and then together they fought their way back to Australian lines. And it was for that action, and Jacka returned with an incredible number of wounds as a result of this fighting, that he was recommended for the award of a bar to his Victoria Cross. But Jacka was a controversial soldier in that he didn't think twice about telling anybody what he thought of them and what he thought of their attacks. And you wonder whether a plain-speaking man like him, a much-needed plain-speaking man like him in the trenches of the Great War, perhaps upset some people and the recommendation didn't go through because of that. Who knows? That's been lost in the midst of time. But Jacka, many people felt, had been robbed of his medal, so no bar was ever awarded to any Australian soldier for the Victoria Cross for their bravery in the Great War, and certainly not to Jacka. He did go on to get the Military Cross, and like I say, he fought in other battles of the Great War, and there's an incredible amount of literature about him, and it's well worth looking into, because he is no doubt, the war defined him, and he really didn't know what to do when the war was over. I remember reading one account of him said that when he died as a relatively young man in his father's arms, he said, "Dad, I'm still fighting." And I'm sure, just like that dedication to Rowlands for the duration about the Rifle Brigade, hinting at the experience of ex-servicemen post-war when they returned home, it would be similar for Australian soldiers, for diggers like Jacka. What do they do with their lives when the war is over and they go back to ordinary civil life? How can the world ever be the same again when you've experienced all this? And I think that reflecting on the recent trip I've made to Italy and how I've thought about the veterans that I've travelled around those battlefields with, and standing here now at the Elbow where so much fighting took place, many thousands of Australians and then later Canadians and of course many German soldiers died, it isn't just the dead. The dead are the most visible reminders of any conflict on any battlefield, and when we come here we see and rightly visit the cemeteries. But the forgotten survivors who returned home, we have to think of those as well, and I think the battlefields do give us that beacon to do it. The locations like this, where stories unfold about men who survived the Great War. This wasn't the end of their war, it was one part of it. And we think of those survivors, and we think of what they made of their experiences, and we think of what they thought of this part and so many other parts of the old front line.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.